in most Protestant denominations. The ecclesia leads to certain points of unity, or and not uniformity, but unity of understanding, points of agreement. And there are blanks for several of these. The first generally is seen as a holy and living God. There is a holy and living God who has the right to be sovereign and to do whatever God chooses to do. God is holy, God is alive, and it is God's right to determine whatever God wishes to do, because God is God. The second is the lordship and atonement of Jesus Christ. Churches in general will agree, in Protestant and in Catholic communions, with most of these as well, the lordship and the atonement of Jesus the Christ. Most Protestants will also find unity in the idea of a regenerate church membership. Now, those who practice paedobaptism or infant baptism, a little more question about the regenerate church membership. But in most Protestant communions, and especially in Baptist communions, a lot of congregational communions, the idea is church membership are those who have made a profession of faith. They are regenerate because they have made. And make sure it's spelled with an R and not a D. Although some people might think it's degenerate church membership, but we're talking about a regenerate church membership. Although, what better place for degenerates to come to be regenerated, right? Bless you. Number four, all persons have equal access to God. All persons have equal access to God. That's part of the doctrine of the church from a Protestant perspective. Fifth, all believers have equal rights and privileges in the church. Now, not all Protestant communions hold to that. There are some that give certain rights and privileges to certain groups of folks over and above everyone else. But most Protestant communions, most Protestant churches will agree that all believers have equal rights and privileges in the church. In this country, most Protestant communions, and especially we who are Baptist, have preached since the early days a free church in a free state. A free church in a free state. Both the church and the state are free, and they're free from controls over each other. Most Christian communions, period, would agree to the next, the seventh. We are to love our neighbor as ourself because God loves us. We are called to love our neighbor as ourself because God loves us. Glenn Henson, in talking about this idea of the church, said that the integrity of the church rests upon four basic principles. The church is a fellowship of believers. Notice, and he would highlight both of those words, fellowship and believers. The church is a gathered and gathering community. We can't be church if we stay away. We are church as we gather and as we continue gathering. The church is a covenant people. We are in covenant with God and with each other. And that covenant means that we go out into the world. And Henson writes, the church is in a pilgrimage. I started to wear a dark suit and a hat and sunglasses tonight. The church is in a pilgrimage on a mission for God. You know, the Blues Brothers, we're on a mission from God. But the church is in a pilgrimage on a mission for God to minister to the world wherever its life is. That is, wherever the world is. And I would add to that, in other words, the church's mission is to be on the front edge, not in the back room. Our mission is to be on the front edge of sharing with the world, not sitting in the back room waiting for somebody else to do it. Now, that's kind of the unity of the church from a Protestant predominantly Protestant perspective, though many of those things our Roman Catholic brothers and sisters would agree with as well. But there are, which leads me then to different forms of church polity. If we are church, how do we do church? How do we do church? In the how do we govern ourselves? How do we make decisions? How do we go about this mission? In the New Testament, there are three different types of church polity, actually. One of those is the, as you see on the sheet, is the episkopos, the Episcopalian form, the word episkopos. It is governed, it's a highly structured form of government. The Episcopalian form of church polity is one that is governed by bishops and priests and deacons who are under the bishops. Probably the most glaring example of the episkopos or the Episcopalian form of church polity or government would actually not be the Episcopal Church, though it does come from this, but would be the Roman Catholic Church, with the Bishop of Rome, also known as the Pope, as the head, and the power and the words flow from the top down. You've got the Pope. Under the Pope is the College of Cardinals. And interestingly enough, they are the group, when the Pope dies, that chooses the next Pope. Under the College of Cardinals, you've got the Archbishop. The Pope is over the entire see of the Church. S-E-E of the Church. The College of Cardinals work with the Pope. And the College of Cardinals also is divided into various congregations, that is, that oversee different areas, like the Congregation for the Sacred the Sacred Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, goes through all Catholic writings by any person who claims to be a priest or a Catholic theologian or anything, and gives the imprimatur, the stamp of approval, or not. And then there are others that oversee other different groups. Under the College of Cardinals, then, are the archbishops, who are over a large area, but not quite as large as the Pope. And the archbishops are to carry out throughout the world whatever the Pope indicates needs to be done. Under the archbishop, there are bishops, which are over another see, smaller than the archbishop. And then under the bishop is the priest, and under the priest are those who serve in the diaconate, and you do not have to be a celibate priest in order to serve in the diaconate. Mary's best friend from high school, our goddaughter that I did the wedding for in June, Barbara's father was a part of the diaconate, and he had 12 kids. But he was part of the diaconate, and there are certain functions that the deacons do, especially in assisting the priest or in absence of a priest. There's some functions they can do, but other functions they can't. And then under the diaconate is the local congregation in the parish. And all the authority, all the words, ideally flow from the top down. Of course, a similar kind of situation, though not quite as extensive, and we could get into subsets of these, would be the Episcopal Church, but also the Lutheran Church. And in theology and polity, in practice, the Lutheran Church is actually the closest to the Roman Catholic Church of all. But then again, Martin Luther was a priest, and he never intended to leave the church. He intended to change the church from the inside. The second form of church government, or polity, that we find in the New Testament is the presbyteros, or the presbytery. Obviously, we get Presbyterian from that. It is governed predominantly by elders and committees. Although the Presbytery doesn't out-committee Baptists when it comes to committees. And if you recall, a few years ago, we even had a committee on committees here to study the structure of the committees. We're not the only ones that have had committees on committees, though. But the Presbyterian form of government has elders and committees, and the presbytery, both a presbytery that is regional, over certain regions, and a presbytery that is the local church. The elders are divided into two different types within the Presbyterian form of government. There are the teaching elders, who are primarily the ordained ministers, the teaching elders. They are responsible, though they do get involved in some of the practical operations, they are responsible primarily for the spiritual oversight and the spiritual teaching of the entire congregation, the entire presbytery. Then there are ruling elders. The ruling elders are folks who assist the teaching elders in the administration and exercising discipline in the church. The ruling elders are elected to exercise discipline, to help with administrative functions, to determine how money's to be spent, and all of that kind of stuff within the presbytery. The third form that we find within, and there's not a specific name as such, but it comes out with a congregational form, is the congregational form of government in the New Testament. That developed along in time. Actually, as churches were first being formed in different areas, historically, and I won't do it, but I have my what I used to do in a history class for one of my colleagues, my everything you ever want to know about the church history from its foundings up to the Protestant Reformation in an hour and 20-minute class. Tape recorders could not even keep up. But historically, when you began looking at the church and its development and authority, who was considered, after Jesus ascended into heaven and the church began, who was considered kind of the head of the church, the leader in power and authority and say-so? Absolutely, Simon Peter. Now, in the Jerusalem church, it was Simon Peter, but also you had James and some others that fit in there too. But Simon Peter was predominantly the leader of the church, based in large part on a couple of statements that Jesus made, not the least of which is when he said, "You are Petra, the little rock, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades, or the gates of death, will not prevail against it." And then later in Matthew he says, "And to you I give the keys of the kingdom, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." And says, "Oh, well, Peter's got all this power and authority." And that's why later on the church, as it developed, referred to Peter as the first bishop of Rome, which later comes to describe the Pope. Jesus.
Other than that, I mean, was he kind of self-appointed? He just, like Nike, just did it?
Well, Peter kind of, was Peter self-appointed to that, or did he kind of do it? Because of kind of the way Jesus related to him and the authority that Jesus seemed to place in Peter, and you know, Peter's one of those first disciples called, and Peter's the one, whenever you find Jesus going aside to pray, or when he goes in to raise Jairus' daughter, who does he take with him? Peter, James, and John. Peter, James, and John. Up on the Mount of Transfiguration, Peter, James, and John. And Peter is the one who seemed to be the most vocal. Peter's the one when they're on the Mount of Transfiguration and all this takes place, all this wonderful stuff takes place. Peter's the one who whose words are recorded for all posterity, that great philosophical statement. You know, Lord, it's a good thing we were here. We need to build booths and stay here. Or
I thought this might be some kind of atonement. He thought he had to try, or more like Paul did,
Well,
it's time to make amends. And
I think he tried to make amends, and I think he felt he had to do more. But in addition to him being at all those places, when according to the Gospel of Mark, when the women go to the tomb and they find the young man in the tomb, and said, "You know, why are you seeking to live in among the dead? He's not here. Go ahead and tell his disciples and Peter, I am going before you to Galilee." Well, what had Peter done? This big bad Peter, Simon Peter, had denied him and did not even knew him, even with a curse. And so, I mean, he felt pretty lousy and probably like he was on the outs. Well, Jesus specifically in the Gospel of Mark, the angel says, "And go tell the disciples and Peter that he's going ahead." Well, at the end of the Gospel of John, To whom is it that Jesus is speaking when he says, "Do you love me? Then feed my sheep. Do you love me? Then feed my... Do you really love me? Then feed my lambs." It's Simon Peter. And so all of those things combined in the minds of the leaders of the church pointed to Simon Peter as kind of the heir apparent. And then in the book of Acts, when we have Pentecost happens and somebody stands up and preaches and everybody else preaches it in another language, it was Simon Peter who stood up and took the lead. So it's almost by default because of what Jesus has done and said, but it's also in part, I think, because Simon Peter stepped up to the plate.
He also recognized
probably first that it was Jesus Christ that he was that's Matthew's formula. He did recognize him as Messiah, but in Mark the text says, "And who do men say that I am?" And Peter's the first one that speaks up and he says, "You're the Christ." And then Jesus says, "Oh, don't tell anybody," because they're still thinking religious, political king kind of thing. In Matthew records, you know, the Son of the Living God, but still, because of what happens in the garden and later on when Jesus is resurrected and they're all there and they say, "Are you going to restore the kingdom now?" He did. The thing that we can hang on Peter there that he's that really speaks in favor of him is the fact that he was willing to make the statement and commit himself to Jesus as Messiah, even if that meant what he thought it meant, fighting a war, fighting against the Romans. Whatever Jesus was as Messiah, he said, "You're the Messiah. I'm going to follow you." But even with that, he proved his human weakness later on. And so I do think that part of it has to do with what Jesus said. Part of it has to do with the way the disciples looked at him, because he was the one that was down and out after denying Jesus, and he's the one that steps up to the front and says, "Okay, here it is. I'm going to take my stand now." And part of it because at the end of the Gospel of John, and John is one of those three disciples that seems to be on Jesus' inner circle. When he goes into the Garden of Gethsemane to pray, he takes Peter, James, and John. Everybody else kind of settles out here. He takes them in further. So I do think that, Ed, that it's a combination of both. It's what Jesus did and said, and it's also the fact that Peter just kind of took it upon himself to step up and do it. And they recognized that authority. And as the church developed, if you started a church in Antioch in Syria, it was only recognized as a true Christian church if Peter and James and the other leaders in Jerusalem recognized it as such. If they didn't recognize it as such, I mean, historically, this is the way it was. If they didn't recognize it as such, the mother church in Jerusalem, led by Simon Peter, then you were considered out on the fringes and you were not really considered a Christian congregation or followers of the way. And so in the early 10, 15 years along in there, 20 years, Peter had that kind of authority. If he said, "No, your church really doesn't fit the model," then people didn't recognize you as such. And Peter and Paul, although we don't know if they ever hooked up with Mary, but Peter and Paul, sorry, had some run-ins over some things, and Paul corrected Simon Peter, and Simon Peter corrected Paul on some things too. But they eventually tried at least to reconcile and work together. There were some questions about Paul from Simon Peter and going to the Gentiles at first, until Peter had that vision and went to Cornelius' house, the Roman centurion, and realized that the gospel could go to Gentiles too. And so you've got all that interplay, and actually there are many who think, and I think there's some evidence for it, that Jesus said, "Yeah, but those first converts were all Jews." No, those first converts were Jews, and at Pentecost, all those converts were Jews from around the world that were there for Passover and Pentecost, and so there was still that question, and the council that meets in Acts chapter 15 to determine what the criterion, the major criteria are for being a Christian, to decide whether he had to be circumcised or not. That was kind of the big question there. But there is some evidence that the money that Paul mentions, he's taking up a collection to send back to the church at Jerusalem. Part of that was the church in Jerusalem needed some help, but the other part of it was, quite frankly, he was trying to get back in Peter and James' good graces because they had butted heads so much before. So even there, Paul was recognized as kind of the leader within the Gentile church, but Simon Peter still had that leadership role that went way back, and even Paul recognized that within the Jewish part of the church as it developed. Though we've got that kind of form of authority going on, there is still later on in the New Testament there is an emphasis on the congregational form of government, where each congregation, though you may have ties to the mother church, I'd put quotation marks around that, in Jerusalem, each congregation still made its own decisions about how it was going, how its officers were going to be used, the roles, pastors, deacons, elders, whatever, how they were going to function in that particular locale. Even to the point that the church at Sincrate determined that Phoebe could serve as a deacon. And Paul in Romans 16 commends her to the church in Rome as deacon of the church at Sincrate. Because primarily that was a male position. But here it's Phoebe, a female, in the church at Sincrate, in the church with its own sense of polity and autonomy, had her there as a deacon. And so you've got this whole idea that all believers, and in 1 Peter chapter 2, we've got a scriptural basis for the priesthood of the believer in 1 Peter chapter 2. And that comes about in the congregational form more than it does in the episkopos or even the presbyteros. And so these are the three primary forms of church government that come about in the New Testament. And they all coexist, and sometimes they run up against each other. And you do have churches that disagree. When Paul writes to the Galatians, he's writing to the churches of Galatia, because you've got all kinds of bickering and fighting going on there as to who can really be a Christian and who can't be, and what does it mean to be a Christian. The Judaizers say that you still got to be circumcised and keep the law and all this other kind of stuff before you can be a Christian. And the other group, primary group of Gentile Christians there in those churches of Galatia, and it was several churches, are from a Gentile background, and they're saying, no, but we're free. We're free from the law, and we don't have to do that. Of course, they took their freedom too far, and Paul has to remind both groups that freedom has responsibility, but Christ did set you free from the yoke of the law in order to share that responsibility in working with other folks and sharing the gospel. So, all of these, I mean, that's the dynamic, but guess what? We got the same dynamics going on today between all kinds of churches, and even within churches. So it's not something, and I have had people in the past say, well, it was only the advent of denominationalism that caused all this ruckus and all these different things. No, you go back to the New Testament, you got them heads there too. The same kind of stuff has been going on since the church was founded, though in its earliest form in Jerusalem, there seems to have been more harmony than there was later on. But that the biggest conflict initially when it arose, other than what happens in Acts chapter 6 with the... it was still a conflict between the Jewish Christians and the Jewish Christians from a Hellenistic or Greek background, and who was going to take care of the widows and orphans and that kind of stuff. But most of the conflict comes about because of different ideas of how the church should run. Who should have the say-so and who shouldn't. So, unfortunately, that which was supposed to bring people together and hold them together, the church, still, because it's a human institution as well, it's filled with human beings, had all kinds of issues and difficulties. The only, as I said last week, the only perfect church is the one which is nobody. The only perfect church is one without people, because people aren't perfect. But then it's not really the church, is it? Because the church is the people and not the building. So on this side of the grave, there will never be a perfect church. Which means we've always got something toward which to work. Being more perfect and mature. Yes. Yes.
I got to run down the Catholic Church and understand the Pope and the Cardinals, Archbishops and Bishops. Archbishop follows in there, and that would be one person, or is there more than one?
There are, an archbishop is over a see that is generally a larger area. For example, a bishop is over a series of dioceses.
Right. Okay.
And the dioceses involve a number of parishes. And then the archbishop is over a larger area than the bishop, which would include the diocese of various bishops.
Okay.
Bishops would be under that. Now, the interesting thing about all that, not wanting to get too much into what's going on in Roman Catholic Church these days, though, is that you've got European Catholicism, which is one branch. You've got American Catholicism, which is splintered in a lot of ways, and the American Catholic bishops are not in one accord. No Hondas or anything. They're not in one accord about how they should stand on certain issues, and they have taken stands against what the Pope has said on some things. American Catholicism, in a lot of ways, in the last 25 years to 30 years, has really become a thorn in the flesh for the Vatican. And Latin American or Third World Catholicism is seen as a prime missionary field for the Roman Catholic Church, for the Vatican, to have some influence. And quite frankly, within Catholicism as a whole throughout the world, some of the most conservative, almost fundamentalistly conservative, Roman Catholic priests and bishops and parishioners are in Latin American countries. They're very much more conservative than even a lot of European Catholics. And the church is spreading all over, but I don't know. That's just some folks are drawn to that. And quick story, and we'll move on to ordinances and sacraments. I have co-officiated at a number of Protestant Catholic weddings, and on more than one occasion, I can think of two specific occasions where, in conversations with the priest, for some reason, when I've co-officiated those things at the rehearsal dinner, even though we don't have place cards, either if I'm one of the last ones to come through the line or the priest is one of the last ones to come through the line, the only empty seat is beside the other one. So we end up having conversations about a variety of things. And on two different occasions, I have been talking with Catholic priests and gotten in conversations about why they were priests. I'm talking about Catholics who were raised Southern Baptists, and they're the only Catholic members of their entire families, and they were both priests. And on both occasions, in talking with them, found out that it had to do with a sense of certainty that they felt they got within the authority of the church, that line of command, chain of command. And that's why they left. There was too much left, as one of them put it, there was too much left open to chance in my Baptist upbringing. And he said, and I quote, "There were too many questions and too much left to chance and interpretation, and I had to know that if I didn't understand something and had a question, that somebody in this world was given the understanding by God to be able to answer every question. That person was the Pope, and that's why I became a Catholic, because whenever I would ask my Baptist ministers questions and they couldn't give me the definite authoritative kind of thing, or I didn't feel like it was authoritative, I felt frustrated, which I thought was kind of an interesting reason to become a priest, but that gave him a sense of security. which he needed. I did too, but you know that's between he and God. I don't have to answer for him. He doesn't have to answer for me. Thank God. Well, but a lot of people pass the buck, and God and the devil both get a lot of blame that neither one deserves, because people don't want to take responsibility. Yes, Ariel. They would sell things, pool everything. It was almost like a commune. Well, we do. We have places for people to get food, clothing. We do missions work, etc. But what happened? There are probably a lot of different explanations, but one of them, and I know it may sound kind of simplistic, and it may be something that we don't really want to hear sometimes these days, but the more well-established the church becomes in the culture, rather than being marginalized and persecuted, the more the church becomes the status quo, the less there is of doing the sharing and reaching out to others and in the same fashion as before. The church, quite frankly, and there have been some third world theologians who have argued for the last 20 years that one of the reasons for the rapid growth in Latin America and in other third world countries, and they include Africa in that third world, which I think is correct for the most part, and the phenomenal growth that's been being experienced there, to the point that African churches are sending missionaries back to this country to help evangelize Americans. And once again, they are predominantly from a much more conservative, almost fundamentalistically conservative perspective than most American Christians would be, is because they feel marginalized and persecuted, and Christianity has been put down, and they're put down when they, in a lot of these countries, especially in African countries and in Muslim countries in particular, if you convert to another religion, especially Christianity, from the local folk religion or from Islam, as far as your family is concerned, you're dead. In fact, in some Islamic countries, there have been folks where their families put out a contract on them. I mean, really, literally put a contract out on them and wanted them killed because they had disgraced the religion, they had disgraced the family. And I have in the past seen some documentaries where in certain Islamic countries a family member left Islam and became a Christian, and the family paraded through with a picture of the person on a bier, B-I-E-R, going through the town dressed in black and screaming and crying. They were having that person's funeral. Person still alive, but they were having their funeral, saying, as far as they're concerned, they're dead. And so I really think part of, not all, but part of the reason that that's happened is the more affluent the church becomes, the more the church becomes identified with the status quo, the more socially acceptable and higher up the church seems to be, and the less persecuted it seems to be, then the less there is of that communal kind of sharing. And it continues today. A lot of these churches, big mega churches, don't have the tall steeples and spires like the cathedrals, but they're even bigger than some of the cathedrals. And they have multi million dollar budgets and spend multi millions on facilities and screens and bands and all kind. I mean, a lot of these churches pay the musicians, the band that's there. I mean, they draw a salary, and they're professional musicians from the drummer on down. Now, we pay our musicians too, but I mean, these are folks that they get paid more based on the larger crowd because of that. So we still, that's kind of the getting locked into the status quo. And quite frankly, there are fewer and fewer of those those churches that do any real mission work outside of themselves or support missionaries. Unless they're tied to a particular denomination that does that, very few of them support any missionaries or send out missionaries. And by the way, another statistic, the majority, many of the community and mega churches pull in people from other churches to a much larger degree than they do people who are unchurched. The vast majority of people who go there are people who come from other churches. We used to call that sheep stealing, but people from other churches. And that's who the target, quite frankly. And so the more we get in, and so it continues, and it's not just the cathedrals or the other, but it's even the more contemporary kinds of churches that are caught up in that same thing, Harry, in answer to your question. And but I really think it's because the more you become part of the status quo, the more difficult it is to do that. I know we're about out of time, so I just want to give two definitions, and then later, the next time next week we'll have Sinspiration, but the next time we come together for this, we'll then expound upon ordinances and sacraments. Which brings me to, I do need to say, Chris's ordination is in Salisbury, North Carolina, on Sunday night, the 27th. I need to ask Chris for sure if it's at 6 or 6:30. We're going to put a sign-up sheet up if anyone would want to go. If enough people were to sign up and want to go to take the bus, Robert has agreed that he'll drive the bus, but if only 8-10 people, then you can take cars, that kind of thing. And we'll determine by the number of folks that do that whether we'll have service on the night of the 27th or not. However, it's a good, depending on who's driving, it's a good close to 3 hours to get there to Salisbury. I make it to Burlington in 3.5, but if the traffic's, man. But you could let Judy drive, and you wouldn't go to sleep. But you'd also get pulled over. You'd also get pulled over by the Blue Bar Boys, run that little blue light. But no, just Judy's not here to defend herself. But so we'll either the 27th or the 4th is when we'll be back to this. But I did want to mention that. I was supposed to mention it earlier. We'll put up a sign-up sheet if you want to. But you're talking about 3 hours to get there. And then the service will last at least an hour, maybe an hour and a half, and then another 3 hours to get back. So, plus some time to eat. So, yeah. Most people have to eat twice. Sarah wants to go through McDonald's 3 times. But, quickly, two definitions. An ordinance. This is on the other handout. An ordinance. Something ordained or decreed by Christ. Something ordained or decreed by Christ. To be done as a rite of initiation or remembrance. An ordinance is something ordained or decreed by Christ, which is to be done by the church as a rite, R-I-T-E, of initiation or remembrance. The rite of initiation is baptism. That's our ritual for it. We're initiated into the group. Remembrance, of course, would be the Lord's Supper. And Baptists and most Protestant, most congregational Protestants hold and use the word ordinance. And we say there are two that were ordained by Jesus: baptism and the Lord's Supper. A sacrament. And this is the official definition. A sacrament is an outward sign instituted by Christ with the power to give grace. An outward sign instituted by Christ with the power to give grace. According to the documents of Vatican II, the purpose of a sacrament is to sanctify men, women too, but to sanctify men, build up the body of Christ, and give worship to God. The purpose of a sacrament is to sanctify men, build up the body of Christ, and to give worship to God. Depending on the theology and the particular denomination, a sacrament is a necessary part of salvation or not. But in Protestant theology, when you talk about ordinances, ordinances are not considered a necessary part of salvation. The Lord's Supper, for most would be considered, for definitely Roman Catholicism, for the Lutheran Church, Episcopalian Church, some Presbyterians and others, it's called a sacrament because it reminds, but you also are participating with Christ and receiving His grace. Within Baptist congregations and a lot of other Protestants, congregational forms of government, it's an ordinance, and we'll talk next time about what really takes place. Is it the Roman Catholic idea of transubstantiation that actually changes to flesh and blood, or is it the Episcopalian and some others in the middle there, consubstantiation, that is, flesh and blood exist together with, con means together, together with the flesh and blood are there together with and alongside the bread and the drink? Or is it simply a symbol? S-Y-M-B-O-F. By which we remember. And all of those churn together in Christian doctrine as a whole. My systematic theology professor, Dr. James Tull at Southeastern Seminary, used to use the word sacrament as a Baptist, but he said in his definition the sacrament was a reliving of an experience. Not necessary for salvation, but it was a reliving of the experience. So that when we participated in baptism or we participated in the Lord's Supper, we were actually vicariously reliving what Christ did. But that it was not a sacrament from the standpoint of giving you grace or necessary for salvation. But we'll start with questions about that next time. And then talk just briefly about those. I'm not going to make this a real long thing. We could spend more than 45 to 50 minutes just dealing with that issue. We could spend a couple of hours easily, but we won't. Any other questions before we go? If not, then as you go, know this. We are the church, called apart, set apart, to be what Christ needs us to be in sharing grace and redemption with each other as well as with those outside. Be vessels of grace. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.